you folks listening to this just don't know how lucky you are. There's no webcam in here. That theme tune kicks us off for another season, and we've got our guests dancing in the studio like no one's watching, which is just as well. You're listening to the Albion Roar in association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at Radio Reverb, on DAB, on Spotify, and on our podcast on Audio Boom. We're everywhere. With the World Cup done and dusted for another 4 years, it hardly feels like we've been able to catch our breath, and the domestic football season is rapidly approaching. The Albion have made key acquisitions, and on next week's show, we'll be discussing them and the season ahead. This week, however, we'll be picking over the bones of the World Cup with football writer Nick Japanek. Hi, Nick.
Good afternoon. Compliments to the new season.
And to you too. And writer and comedian, a probably frustrated comedian, we'll find out in a minute, Mark Brailsford, who himself went to Russia to see what it was all about.
Hello.
Hello there. By the way, at the top of this, I haven't put my notes. My name's Alan Wares. AD is elsewhere, sunning himself in the north of England. Gents, first and foremost, the World Cup. Thoughts? Your overall impressions of the tournament?
Well, let's talk to the man who was actually there on the ground.
Yes. Thank you.
How much impression of the whole tournament do you get from wherever you are?
Well, this is the thing. You get the feeling when you're there how vast the country is. So actually, I dipped into sections of it. So, you know, I didn't get to see a game, for example, in Sochi. But I did Samara for the Sweden game. I went to, well, started in Moscow, ended up in Samara, went back to Moscow for the semi-final. Ostensibly to stay for the final, we hoped. You never knew. But I wasn't actually going to go. The whole point was we weren't going.
Why was that?
Well, after Nice, which we all know what happened 2 years ago.
Right.
The nadir, really.
Yes.
And it was so depressing. And slowly, all the guys I used to go to the England games with, we all drifted off except for a few. A good mate of mine, John Valance, who was always we organised with these things and goes to England games as well. And he held fast. And he said, "Are you going to Russia?" I said, "No, not going to Russia. No way." He said, "Well," I said, "what about you?" "No, I don't think so." And then he said, "But what if? if they get to the..." He said, "Let's have an insurance policy. We'll get tickets because we were England fan club members." Right. "It will book those ones where you can, if they get there, you can get a ticket." So we've got the semi-final and the final in case England made it. Thinking, we're not going, can't afford to go, it's all going to be horrible, the propaganda's horrendous, we're going to get killed, and it's all sorts.
Again,
yes. So, and let's face it, it's England in a World Cup. It's not going to happen.
What could possibly go wrong?
Exactly. And then, look, lo and behold, I mean, it was amazing. And I have to say, Russia was incredible. I loved it.
So where did you go?
Well, it was very last minute. I flew into Moscow, literally after two days decided. Yep, flew into Sheremetyevo, if that's how you pronounce it. Still couldn't pronounce the Russian. I usually try and get on top of the language before I go.
Did you have a go at the Cyrillic?
I did. He was a nice bloke. Nice one he was. nice one, Cyrillic.
Whenever I've been on trips to see, you know, to see games as a journalist in places where they use Cyrillic, I find that half an hour spent on the plane just before landing makes you the biggest expert on Cyrillic in the whole of the British media. So talk about in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. You say, "Oh, this is the way we're going, boys." And they say, "How do you know that?" I say, "It's written up there. How do you know that?" So, yeah, no, it doesn't... Yeah, a little knowledge.
There is a kind of decoding of certain letters which we see. Like, for instance, the C is an S, and you've got that sort of asterisk, which is... I don't know what it is. That's the Z, I think, isn't it? Or the three is the Z, and you've got the one that looks like a TV monitor. And there's certain combinations where they don't have letters where we do.
Like, well, what I like is that there's one character for the first four letters of my surname.
Oh, of course, yes. So was it more natural for you to sort of understand Cyrillic?
Once you've translated the Cyrillic, then you've got to deal with the fact that it's a different language. But I've got some clue from Polish.
Well, it does help to... You can anglicise some of it. Like, for example, I was staying my digs the second time I got back to Moscow. I couldn't quite work out the Cyrillic, but it looked like lesbian thong baps. So whenever I looked at it, I saw something that looked like those words. And, of course, that made it memorable.
Which was... and you'd follow that anyway, wouldn't
you? Well, you would. So, Moscow's full of beautiful women.
The way you're describing that's the word football, isn't it?
Well, that's another way of playing, yes.
Yes. Okay, fine, yeah. So anyway, you flew to Moscow.
Yeah, so we get in. I get in. I booked a train, and it was a Uzbekistan railway train, third class, going to basically Samara, which is basically the border of Kazakhstan. It's 1,000 kilometres south.
Right.
And it's hot and it's sticky. And I was on a train for 16 hours in third class with Kazakh families, chicken on the roof type yeah. environment.
There's a Southern Lovely Rail people. Joke there somewhere.
Well, exactly. It was more luxurious and faster than a Thames Lincoln or Southern Rail. Exactly. Yes. So having luxuriated in third class for 20 minutes in the heat, I think I can't bear this. Yeah. Bribed my way into second class.
Right.
And had a very nice, comfy air-conditioned compartment, and very nice it was too. It seems to be the done thing there, so I went, oh, fine, so mm-hmm. paid an extra fare. And I literally, that's a terrible word, literally, I hate using it, but I couldn't help it, but I did not actually stop moving after I arrived in Samara, put the bag in left luggage, kept going, and it's a huge distance. That's one of the World Cup stadium that is way out of the city.
Right.
You go past the big rocket because it's a Baikonur base and all that, where you know the Russian space program's based. And you spend ages on this rattly old tram that you have to pretty much get out and push.
Now you're back to Southern, aren't you?
Yeah, and I'm still thinking this is actually still more comfortable than a Southern Rail train. And then you have to walk, which actually probably is the alternative to a Southern Rail train that probably gets you to London quicker. So you get there, Samara was weird because you're watching a more or less comfortable performance. I was with Russians.
Sorry, which game was this? Was it Sweden?
Sweden 2-0. I mean, the thing to remember though is Pickford's saves in that game. There were two magnificent saves that could have changed the complexion of that game.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an unusual World Cup game, sat there enjoying it, relaxed and having a great time.
I'm loving the fact that you actually said, that you're doing part of the tourist bit, where you're saying, we went past this rocket site. So there's another bit of sort of Russian history that you've actually picked up just by going past it. I mean, you could have had the guidebook, but...
What you missed by being there was Ali McCoist's potted history of Russia and the Soviet Union whenever he was commenting. It was always a joy to have Ali McCoist summarising because... He was without doubt one of the best summarisers. Not that the bar was set very high.
I was going to say, which brings us to, bearing in mind that we were talking about this just before we came on air, you actually wanted to have a little critique of the various pundits. Fire away, Nick.
Oh,
see if you get any more freelance work.
Well, no, McCoy stands out because he got a bit of wit and a bit of interest. It sounded like he was enjoying it. Mark Lawrenson, I mean, I can't bear to listen to the guy. I know he's an Albion legend. But there was one moment, it has been pointed out, where he said, who's the ref today? You think you've got a team sheet there, Mike. Mark, if you're too lazy even to look down at the team sheet and find out who the referee is and where he's from, you despair. And Phil Neville, the master of the bleeding obvious.
Yes.
And, and the lack of knowledge, hoping that Uruguay will go further than they've ever gone before. They've won it twice, you moron. And then, we all know about Evra's applauding of Eniolouko for making comments far more sensible than he was. But what almost depressed me as much was Jackie Oakley, who's a friend of mine, then saying, oh, she's good, isn't she? I mean, how much do you want to patronise a fellow woman? Of course, if she's not good, why is she there? Phil Neville and Mark Lawrenson,
doesn't it? I think you've just answered your own question there, haven't you? So, did you enjoy the punditry? I think on BBC they seem to have a little bit more of a genuine bonhomie about them.
I certainly agree with Ali McCoy's summaries. They were fantastic when he suddenly referred to Peter the Great and the history 500 years ago. That was, I think it was just a tug-in-cheek to begin with, and then he realised he was onto something.
Who was
and he it was very
commentating
good.
With?
John Champion.
Every time, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were together everywhere, weren't they? And they clearly had a rapport, which is obviously important when you've got a co-commentator there. And I think that matters. And to be fair, I think some of the commentators have been excellent. And there were some moments of real poetry in some of the commentary, not Mr. Tisdale. Is it Tisdale?
Tilsley.
Yes, it sounds like something from Norman Wisdom. Mr. Tilsley!
People like Shearer have taken on board criticism and they've risen to the occasion and they've upped their game. I think Shearer's done well. I think, I think most of the time it was a big improvement. But there are still those people and you just think, why is this person on? They must be able to get somebody better.
Okay, if you listen to this, just drop us a line on Twitter. Who were your pluses and minuses for commentators and pundits? I mean, we haven't even mentioned Glenn Hoddle yet, have we? So, you think you're talking about Phil Neville and the art of the obvious?
And then you've also got the Shout Sport channel. Obviously we like Hawksbeam Jacobs. I thought their show was excellent. Actually, funny.
They are very they're top guys. Now I've been on their show a couple of times, plugging books. No, but these are funny guys, and they know the sport. I mean, I'm in awe of some of their knowledge of fairly obscure sports, or even their research, which is part of the battle. But fair play for them doing it because not everybody does, as we know.
So I'd love them to commentate on Stallball next, then.
Motti's he's on TalkSport next season.
He is now, yeah. That was great to see him. Yeah. Mm. I thought, obviously, the retirement wasn't, he's just stopping completely. Mm. Maybe the BBC
retired him.
But it's a shame because he's still, you know, he's as vital as he ever was.
I can't help feeling that over the past, I don't know, 10 years, he kind of got excited at the wrong moments and made really good stuff look banal. I mean, if you saw that the documentary just before the World Cup on him, he just come across as a sort of, I don't know, there's an OCD grouch is what came across. You know, the lovely story of him in Hanover in the World Cup in Germany, and he's absolutely concentrating on everything, but he realises that the sun is actually over the stand opposite, and he's looking at his stuff and he's just shouting to his minions, "Can someone do something about that?" You know, well, it's the sun, Motti. You know, what do you expect us to do? Turn it off.
His finest moment for me was when that Paraguay player firmly headed past his own goalkeeper from Beckham's free kick in that England World Cup game, and about 5 minutes later, he said, "I say, Mark, there's a slight suspicion of an own goal about that, isn't there?"
Well done.
I miss Barry Davis, actually.
Barry Davis is the man for me. Yeah.
The erudition, the connection.
They did something on him just before Wimbledon, didn't they?
He was a real talent, wasn't he?
He came across as a very likable man, I must say.
Yeah. I mean, I just think with Davis, his World Cup, I think his World Cup sort of top moment was the Bergkamp goal in the last minute against Argentina. Mm. You know, the way that he took down De Boer's pass.
Mm. Oh, what a goal.
And then
as well,
just smash it past the keeper. I mean, there was the real sort of schoolboy element of excitement, and it wasn't over the top. I mean, it was a genuinely brilliant goal, and it's just the perfect way of describing it, the perfect
pitch.
That's
the whole thing about this World Cup, actually, harking back a bit to those eras of those different commentators as well. But this is the thing, that the World Cup recovered its historical weight, if you like, its meaning, its emotional connection. I felt connected to it probably because of England too, but I felt there was other things that connected me to the World Cup. The reason I went was actually also partially because of in 2002 when I went to Japan, me and Paul Hodgson wrote together and put on Ronaldo Ate My Credit Card, which was the story of going to the Japan World Cup.
Right.
So now, and I was out there writing the sequel, Harry Kane Ate My Credit Card. So here we go again, you know. So the play will be born. We started work. So that will be appearing somewhere in October.
Because I've seen you do Mushy Ate My Credit Card.
That's
about
the
Sussex
second
winning.
In the oeuvre. Yeah, that was the cricket version. So we've got Ronaldo Ate My Credit Card, and then Mushy Ate My Credit Card actually went to Edinburgh Festival and toured and did really, really quite nicely, actually. I was quite pleased with that one. And Ronaldo actually half covered my cost of the trip to Japan. So, so I'm hopeful that this one does the same job. Because Russia wasn't cheap.
No, but okay, so if I can rewind 10 minutes, what were your overall impressions of the World Cup?
Probably the first one for a while. Well, I've managed to watch almost every game except, well, you know, the simultaneous ones in the last group game, and watched them in a heck of a lot of different rooms and venues and outdoors, arenas in some cases. Watched a couple in a care home in Salt Dean, in the Extra Street Hall in our local community place. Oh, no, fantastic. And every game seemed to be an event somehow. And I think a lot of that was made by the supporters in the stadiums who travelled in vast numbers. And, you know, from the unlikeliest venues, you know, with so many Colombia fans managed to get to Russia and... Mm. They obviously hadn't been briefed in advance about the likely problems. I didn't really think there would be problems in Russia, because I just didn't think Putin would allow it. By all accounts, some of their crazies were invited to take holidays elsewhere for the duration.
Right.
So
yes, that clearly was the case.
Yes, it's always good to have a strong man occasionally.
Well, that's it with Russia, isn't it? I mean, these vast countries, you kind of get a glimpse of it. You never really understand it just by visiting briefly. But there is certainly a glimpse of massive countries like Russia. And I did a play about... written by Dostoevsky last year. I got steeped into the Russian literature side of it, and culturally it's got this huge past, which I was really in love with, so I loved it, going to St. Petersburg, for example. But the thing about vast countries like that, the tendency to hold them together with a centre does end up requiring strong men leadership, usually men leadership, and that is sometimes culturally where we don't always understand countries. We don't understand culturally where they've come from that's led to this, shall we say, dictatorial way of running countries. Not our way, and thankful that it's not that way, because we do know there are things that aren't propaganda that are true about Russia. But there's definitely a lid on everything. But I have to say, the people, and you just regard the politics,
they were proud to host it.
They were great, and you can't fake every single person I met who was so amazing.
Oh, right.
I can't speak more highly of the people generally. They were amazing.
And all the strong men have always been able to appeal to the love of the motherland.
Exactly.
That's the thing. Yeah. I mean, they are, Russians are very proud and patriotic.
Yes, they are. Absolutely.
I was very disappointed. I thought my noble profession failed in one way. I was looking for all the headlines or the intros about another German defeat in Russia, harking back to to Stalingrad and Moscow.
Great joke, though.
And no, I'm sorry, but anyway, but Germany going out has that any competition where that happens, I'm sorry.
That had some chuckle factor,
but it
didn't
was wonderful.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah,
great for the treason show. We went to town with that one.
What is the German for Schadenfreude? But I mean, the football generally. I mean, across 64 games, to my mind, there was probably what two or three gammy games, and that was about it, wasn't it?
I think, though, some great attacking performances up to the final third, to get technical. I think that there wasn't a great goal scorer in this World Cup.
No.
You know, the fact that Harry Kane won the Golden Boot with a couple of penalties and one that went in off his heel, he should have just been too embarrassed to accept it. That's the problem. I mean, you look back on some World Cups and you think, Scalacci or whoever. Who was the defining player? I mean, it was probably... it was probably a midfield player or a defender. It might have been, Modric. And he did, in fact, score a couple of great goals. He scored one fantastic goal in that.
And he was the difference in that semi-final, definitely. I mean, that's what we missed. We were talking earlier.
This is what I wanted to move on to next. Let's talk about the four semi-finalists, France, Belgium, England and Croatia. I mean, it's probably fair to say that England were by far the weakest of the four. We'll get on to sort of how England got on with later. But of the other three semi-finalists, I mean, you probably wouldn't have fancied playing any of them. I mean, because I think, although Argentina were poor, Croatia still took them apart.
They were a much better side than people gave them credit for.
Absolutely.
And
more people than, as Modric screamed and grizzled, and I think he was actually kind of a bit graceless after the semi-final win, the English press didn't give us any credit. Well, I think actually the English fans, a lot of people appreciated how good Croatia was. Just obviously historically, Croatia haven't had a great record against England, but when it came to a matter, then they did the business. But you could also see that France and Belgium were clear. I felt were clearly a cut above anyway.
Well, what admit me, and especially out there, because John then came, John Vallis came and joined me for the semi-final, and hopefully it was the final. We were talking about this. What if it was Belgium in the final and England got there? And I was dreading that because you know what the Red Tops would have done. It would have been the Brexit World Cup final.
Well, it would have been the same with France as well,
And that was the thing, going about South Americans, the Peruvians were still there, the Colombians were everywhere. We were the banana republic with terrible things happening at home and the football team actually saving us and distracting us with joy.
Yeah.
And so I very much felt that it was a weird turnaround being abroad in that situation, being an England fan. It's that, this is the thing that's taking our minds off all the rubbish going on.
And also to be in a country that's basically turning its back on a large chunk of the world.
So
I mean, do you also feel that with the propaganda before the World Cup that actually England fans did actually miss out on a really good tournament?
Yeah, but it kept the idiots away as well. So, you could argue...
It's kind of chucking the baby out with the bathwater, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of fans who would have gone and loved it didn't go because of the propaganda. And to be fair, I think genuinely people were worried after what happened in Marseille. It was horrific. But I didn't see that. We avoided it because, you get a nose.
It's easy to avoid the nonsense, isn't it?
You know where the idiots are going to be. And you try and avoid it. And you don't go, those areas of it's going to kick off. If you can help it, you can get caught up. But if you've got... half a brain, you should be able to avoid it. And the whole thing about looking at the England team generally as well, and the nation's feeling and the joy of it, the hot summer and all that. But it's this progressive and diverse team showing the best of us. And that's the thing I loved about it. Being abroad and proud of the England team was an unusual feeling.
Sure. I mean, I want to talk about England a little bit later on. But like I said, let's go back to the four semi-finalists. What did they have that England didn't?
Good midfield players. They, if you look at them, they all had real performers in the centre of midfield. That was our one area. Well, it was our area of most glaring weakness. That we haven't
more so
had,
than us than the strikers.
Well, the trouble is the strikers can only do so much with the service they get.
Okay.
And you looked at where Belgium and the playmakers they had. Just look at Modric. Rakitic, Perisic from the wings, where were our equivalents? But where have they been for a while? I mean
Jordan Henderson. I'll try not to zero in on Jordan Henderson, but I mean he's the big hope for England. And if you compare him to, like you say, Modric, and for France you've got Pogba and Griezmann. Incidentally, Paul Pogba. What on earth has Mourinho been doing that?
I just hope he keeps doing it.
Well, quite. Because, I mean, for me, it's always up for debate. I actually felt that Paul Pogba was the player of the tournament. I think he was the one that really directed everything. I won't say he was as good as, you know, Zidane or Platini, but he was the one that really sort of directed the traffic for
but
France.
But you see, it's not Jordan Henderson's fault that he's Jordan Henderson. I mean, he's asked to play a role. He does it to the best of his abilities, and I think, you know, he's transcended, I think, what a lot of people thought were his limited abilities. But you can't ask him to stand up on his own, which is pretty well what he had to do, to Modric, Rakitic and the Croatia team. And I was just thinking, surely he's got to put Dier in there alongside him just to sort of stem the tide. But in the end, he replaced like for like. You know, I think
I think the group game that Dier played in, well, what an appropriate name he had. I mean, he played against Belgium, and how good was Eric Dier? You know, I think his name answers
the
question.
He was one of the few decent players we had 2 years ago. But going back to Jordan Henderson, the thing about, I don't know if it, how it looks on television that game, because I obviously it was a different view.
Are we talking about the Croatia game?
Talking about the Sweden game and the Croatia game, both games. And as you know, watching a game live is slightly different, right? So I have to say, Jordan Henderson, who I agree with, certain limitations, wasn't sure of, but he was asked to do too much. But then we were missing that extra creative player. Lesser Dier, perhaps more sadly unfit, Jack Wilshere wasn't there. That kind of player who could have unlocked the defence, certainly in that game against Croatia, we didn't have that retention of the ball that actually Gareth Southgate does preach, and it just didn't quite work there, because and I think the Jordan Henderson I think he played very, very well, actually.
I think, as Jordan Henderson can or can't play, I think he was as good as he can be. But if we want to progress,
he needed that extra player with him, but perhaps a more progressive player.
I wouldn't criticise Henderson. I mean, he played above himself almost, but we need more, and we haven't really. I don't see that player, an England qualified player, perhaps in the youth teams coming up. But is
Harry
Lewis
Winks.
Cook really that?
Harry Winks, I think, is
Harry
a
Winks
great
is a possible.
Potential.
Sessegnon in the next few years,
tempo player, you know.
Sessegnon, wide player. Can he play inside? Probably can. He'd probably play anywhere. Yeah, he's a brilliant player. But there you go. You see, it's a question of where players. I always thought Joe Cole was going to be that player for us, because when he came through with West Ham, he was a number 10. He went to Chelsea. He could only get in the Chelsea team as a wide player.
Marine
therefore
again.
He got played in the England squad as a wide player. Very occasionally we'd see him in the number 10 role, but not often enough. We need a player who's playing Premier League football or La Liga or somewhere, week in, week out, in that number 10 role. You know, we don't have a Totti or a Pirlo. Never had a player like that.
I think Southgate gets that, though. And that's the encouraging thing. Southgate for me was a revelation, and I love him.
All I'd say is some of his substitutions were like for like instead of tactical. I think when a game needed changing, he didn't do it. He just took off a left back and put on another left back. He didn't put an extra midfield player in or something like that. But it's a question, as you said, of what he's got at his disposal, really.
Sure. Well, and perhaps learning too. I think he'll accept that with the team. He said we're growing. I think that's probably applies to him, really.
Sure. I mean, if we're doing a compare and contrast, then we'll talk about the rest of the. I was actually going to say we'd do the England team later,
but we'll draw back to England.
That's fine. But then you look at, like I say, what Belgium have got. They had De Bruyne, and they had who the hell was it? Hazard.
He was unhappy though, wasn't he, De Bruyne, until later on.
Yeah, quite. But they, France had two players in midfield. I'm going to say that we had one with a half firing Dele Alli.
Jesse Lingard, they both attack and leave Henderson alone there.
No, but the point is that I felt that, well, of those who are supposedly creative players, they weren't as creative as they could or should have been. I mean, is that down to Southgate? Is it down to their specific talents? Are they being asked to do a job they're not familiar with? I mean, you know, for all the fact that there is some creativity in there, it was still misfiring.
It wasn't the final ball creativity, though, was it? It's that technical.
Apart from Trippier,
Pirlo got mentioned.
But see, Lingard was playing in a strange position. That was neither one thing nor the other. It's not really the position he plays for his club side, I don't think. Alli, I mean, it's a difficult one. I mean, they're all being asked to play, you know, with different people. And Alli he did score that one goal, but in a lot of the games, he wasn't really much of an influence, I don't think.
So.
I think England, generally speaking, since we're here now, let's talk about it. I think they went round in par. You know, they beat the teams that you'd have expected them to beat. They lost to teams you'd have expected them to lose to. Possibly the Sweden game was, as you say, a bit easier than it might have been. But we had two fantastic saves from the goalkeeper.
Yes.
And Colombia, Okay, we won a penalty shootout, but we allowed a centre-half to score when we had three central defenders and Eric Dier in the penalty area.
Yes, I agree. And if Colombia had played football and not rugby, I think they'd have won.
We'll talk about the South Americans a little bit later. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, just about everywhere in your ears. And we are sponsored, as ever, thank you, returning sponsor, Phil Shelley of oldfootballshirts.com. Now, oldfootballshirts.com is an online gallery of, well, over 90,000 football shirts now. I mean, as football shirt sites go, it's the anorak of all sites. He's sponsored this show again for us this season, and once again he's given us a shirt of the week, which I showed to Nick earlier. I can't actually show it to you now because I don't have the facilities to do so, which when you're on webcam, I don't care. Nick, you saw the shirt. Describe it for us. And what do you believe it might be?
It's a beautiful blue with a yellow band across the chest.
Which, Mark, you haven't seen it yet, so does that sort of ring any bells for you?
Sounds like a football shirt.
Yeah.
That's about as far as I could go.
The chest band's beloved of the South Americans, and I believe it to be Boca Juniors.
It is. It says, Phil says, in case you hadn't guessed the team, here's a clue. Fate O is an Argentinian tyre manufacturer. I don't know how that's a clue, but fair enough. This is the 86-87 home shirt of current Argentinian champions Boca Juniors. A simple yet iconic design that stood the test of time. Just take a look at their history on oldfootballshirts.com, please do. They are known as the Cheneses after the Genoese immigrants who founded the team and lived in La Boca area of Buenos Aires in the early 20th century. They have not been out of the top flight since 1913. That's when they were first promoted to the top division in Argentina. They play at the emblematic 49,000 capacity La Bombonera, the official name of which is the Estadio Alberto J. Armando. The pitch is always kept to the minimum size allowed by FIFA of 105 by 60 metres, the stuff that Phil comes up with. La Bombonera means chocolate box. The stadium is nicknamed this due to its shape, with a flat stand on one side on the pitch and three steeply banked stands around the other three sides. The story of the iconic kit goes back to 1906. Boca played Nottingham de Almagro. I do love the way that how many Argentinian sides are named after English places. Both teams had similar colour kits, black and white stripes, so they decided the winners would keep their chosen kit colours. Boca lost and decided to adopt the colours of a flag of the first boat to sail into the port of La Boca afterwards. I just love this story to be true. I'm sure it is, but you know, it was a Swedish boat and the famous blue and yellow colours were adopted. Is that true? I'd love it to be true.
Because he wasn't the Jolly Roger. That'd be
black and white, you're back to square one. All-time top scorer for juniors is Martin Palermo with 193 goals in 318 appearances during his two spells with the side before his retirement in 2011. Roberto Muzzo holds the record for the most appearances for the one side. A one-club man, he played 426 times between 71 and 84. Maradon is often lauded as La Boca's most famous son. His stats don't really seem that impressive. 70 appearances in two spells with 35 goals. Oh, and we have to admire his blubbing fat mush at the Kazan Stadium in Russia to remember as well. So, thanks very much indeed for that. Like I say, you're listening to the Albion Roar. You might be wondering if I've stuck AD under the patio, Trevor Jordash style. He's actually in Chester at the moment, and I'm hoping that by the wonders of modern technology, I can hear him on air now. AD, are you there, mate?
I guess that Boca Juniors shirt straight away.
I think everyone did, mate.
I've not even seen it.
Quite. So, AD, how are you? More to the point, where exactly are you?
Would you be amazed to hear I'm in a pub?
Like, who knew? Who knew?
I'm in a place called Hoole.
Yes.
Which is just outside of Chester.
Yeah.
And Chester Races is going on today, so it's all a bit hectic and everyone's all dressed up in their finery and looking quite splendid.
Why are you in
the
Chester?
The sun is not shining.
And why are you in Chester?
It's where the outlaws come from.
Ah, right, fair enough.
And so it's where my lovely Erica hails from also. So I'm just up here with Molly and them and we're having a fine time. I'll be back in the hot seat next week.
Fantastic. So we've just been talking about the World Cup and we're talking about various aspects of it. In summary, what was your take on the World Cup? Do you enjoy it?
It was fantastic. I mean, some people are saying the fact that England did so well in it is why people are rating it so much. I think I actually enjoyed the one in Brazil more for different reasons. But I think it was a marvellous tournament. There was a lot of colour, that none of the problems that were predicted before the tournament actually arose. So the problems with hooliganism. And, I'm sure that Mark, who was over there, has more to say about that.
He's regaled us with many tales from Russia, and I'm sure has plenty more. You'll dine out on them, I'm sure.
He probably will, and I look forward to hearing them. But, you know, it was a tournament that was blessed with great goals, with some emerging talent. I mean, none of the top stars really turned up, it seems. And Messi scored one great goal. You've got Ronaldo, who had that game against Spain, I suppose, which was the game of the tournament, possibly. I mean, there was a lot of great games. There was only the 1-0. Yeah. But what we actually have to be careful of is England got to the semi-finals for the first time since 1990. That's been well documented. But this... this was an England team managed by a guy from Sussex, and which is something which we should be proud of.
Yeah.
It's an England side that captured the imagination of the public and did more for the country than any politician has ever done. But let's not forget, this was not a great England side. It wasn't. It was as a team that was a sum of its parts. There's no real star player in there.
Mm.
And we did, and the draw opened up for us. We did well to get to the semi-final, but it's building blocks. And what we've got to do now is make sure that the players that are coming through, the ones that want the World Club Championships, the under-19s, the under-20s, are given a clear pathway to actually play at top level and push that team forward. And I know that if they do, then Gareth will give them the opportunity to shine in the England team.
Provided the FA don't do something stupid like offload him he blew off in public or something. For the World Cup in general, I mean, did you have a particular favourite goal?
I think, the one that won the goal of the tournament, actually. Pavard's goal. It's just that there's that camera angle of it where you're just watching the ball swerving into the corner out of the outreached palm of the goalkeeper. It was just beautiful cinematography. Love it.
It was something like straight out of a Roy of the Rovers type sort of cartoon, wasn't it? I mean, you could even see
the
blat sign of where he's hit it. And
I mean, you could imagine that coloured Well, no, you remember the Grange Hill opening titles?
Oh, yeah, with the sausage being nicked,
You could just imagine that appearing in there with a ball curving around, with a sausage coming in the middle, obviously. Clearly, that would work.
And in all the middle of this, was there anyone in the England setup? I mean, you were saying that it wasn't a great England side, but is there anyone in the England setup that you... I mean, obviously Southgate, who I think there seems to be an awful lot of love for in the country, but someone who you felt really... raised their game and actually came out of that with their stock really sort of inflated and risen.
Kieran Trippier is one that we know as Brighton fans. We've seen him a few times. Mm-hmm. Harry Maguire, when he was originally put in the team, there was a lot of question marks from us in particular. We were wondering how this guy got in the side ahead of Lewis Dunk, but he proved why. And actually, I could actually see Lewis playing alongside him, and that would be fantastic.
I'll talk about that with Nick and Mark in a minute. But obviously England did well. Like you say, it's something to build on. But obviously, the next thing we've got to build on is the Albion season. So the new season, the Albion Roar, fires up next week. What can we look forward to this season?
We're working on some new features. We've got. Obviously, Andy Bass. There'll be a lot of Andy Bass.
The ubiquitous Andy Bass.
There'll be some Marcus Hancock. There'll be some Mark Brailsford. There'll be some Nick Trepanic. There'll be some Mark Lawrenson. There'll be...
you wouldn't believe what Nick has been saying about that, so just keep those two apart.
But we've got... We're working on some very special guests, as usual.
Yeah.
We're trying to make the show bigger and better than ever. And let's not forget, it's your show. We do this for you.
Mine? Oh, sorry, everyone, sorry.
And we do this for you. And, you know, if there's something you'd like to see us doing, if there's something we should be doing more of, please just let us know. We've got our Facebook, we've got our Twitter, we've got if you see us again, come and say hi. We're here for you. Let's make this the best.
Okay, and next week we're podcast only because Radio Reverb is being taken over by Brighton Pride, so we'll be doing podcast only. And then the week after that, we're back in our regular slot of 12 midday on Saturday. Looking forward to it, mate.
Yeah, it's going to be good. We're going to be in Watford that day as well, aren't we?
We are. So, but just don't tell everyone. Everyone thinks that we can do this by magic of, you know, teleporting and things like that. Listen, mate, thanks for coming on air. Great stuff. Enjoy Chester. Enjoy the heat wave.
Yeah, the sun's finally come out.
All right. Now, we've had some rain here.
We've had some here this morning. Now I'm looking forward to getting back and getting back in the hot seat.
Absolutely.
And looking for great radio, mate.
Great radio indeed, mate. AD, thanks a lot for coming on, and I'll catch you soon.
See you later, gang.
Cheers. Bye. That's AD Packham, the regular host of the Albion Raw. He's elsewhere by the manager of the power of technology. He's managed to speak to us on air there. I mean, you heard a couple of things he was talking about there. I mean, do you think that he says that Kieran Trippier is the one who's sort of like the one who really shone for England? Do you agree with that?
Among a few. I mean, I think John Stones looked a better defender than I've always thought he was. I always thought he was one of those guys who was great with the ball but wasn't fantastic under pressure.
Do you think playing alongside Harry Maguire helps him?
But equally, I think Kyle Walker was shown up as definitely not being a central defender. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost as if England were looking for another central defender from somewhere. And, you know, where is there another central defender? I mean, the problem with Lewis Dunk, who's the obvious name, is that he likes to play on the left side. That's where Maguire likes to play. And you know, you think, well, you know, just footedness really matter if you're playing centre back? It's more comfortable, obviously, if you've got a left-sided player on the left. And, you know, I suppose Cahill was the backup to Maguire, but I don't think Cahill will be in future England squad, so maybe that's where Lewis should look. But obviously, centre-halves are very important because most of England's goals came from the old-fashioned corner to the head of a centre-half.
In which case, you'd never have Lewis Dunk up then in that case.
Absolutely.
Mr. 50p here when it comes to... I mean, he's perfect at blocking things, great, but when it comes to... You know, so
he's the only defender who scored a goal for the Albion last season.
Well,
so
I didn't know that.
How far from the England setup is Lewis Dunk? I mean, what are your fellow scribes saying as well?
Well, the trouble is, you know, there are people who think, well, Tarkowski is ahead of him. Keane would have been ahead if he'd had a decent season for Everton. I mean, I think, you know, Gareth Southgate is aware of Lewis Dunk, and I think we have to look at the first couple of squads. You know, that he picks in the new season to see. I mean, if he doesn't get in, you know, or in a sort of larger squad for consideration, then that's a problem. But if he decides that Cahill's is probably, you know, the next one is one too far for him, and that he decides to do something else with Kyle Walker, then perhaps there is a space for Lewis Dunk and Tarkowski.
I mean, at the moment, so you feel there's probably a bit too much traffic ahead of him.
I do, and you know, I think one season in the Premier League, perhaps, you know, another good season with more great performances. I don't know what else he could have done last season. You know, there were a couple of odd moments he had, you know, home to Stoke, and one moment where he sort of gifted a ball to Rashford in that Manchester United game. But I think, you know, Dunk had a fantastic season. If that didn't get him in, people will think, well, you know, what's he got to do? But perhaps just do it again.
Okay, I mean, talking of Brighton players, let's run the rule over the Brighton players who were playing in the World Cup. I can actually cheat here and say that there was four, even though there's only technically two, I think, that went and three that played by the time, you know, we got there. So let's talk about, we've got Izquierdo, Ryan, Balogun, and now Jambach. Now, obviously, he wasn't a Brighton player at the time, but hey, he's ours now, so we can actually talk about
him. You've been working on the pronunciation. Well done.
I have, actually, yes.
He had Ali Reza on his shirt in Alkmaar, so maybe that's the way to go.
Okay, it's probably easiest.
Somebody would like to sell as many letters
as
possible.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, well, I've noticed on Twitter the club have been calling him Ali J, so. Yeah. I think probably the one who was most noticeable at the World Cup of the Albion players was probably Matty Ryan. But he had quite a task ahead of him, didn't he?
Well, he didn't have a great Australian outfield team ahead of him, I suppose, to be fair. But, you know, they're still playing Cahill, you know, the Everton Cahill.
Must be 50 years old.
So that shows you. Yeah. It's a shame, actually. They've got a really talented kid who's just been signed, I think, by Manchester United and loaned out to Celtic. Apparently the Australian League star player of the last 3 years. I think it's the United signing, right. Nick. I don't know. You might know.
They tend to do that sort of thing.
But it's a shame that they've got the talent there. But it didn't look as if they were choosing them.
No, it's a shame because Matthew Ryan didn't get a chance to show any particular skills, did he? I mean, he didn't really have a chance when any of the goals went past him. He didn't get a chance to make a really good save, you know, a match turning save. So, you know, he did what he was there to do and didn't get a chance to do much.
Yeah. You know, organise his defence, which is probably what he does. I mean, the fact that when we signed him, everyone was convinced he was basically a goalkeeping midget, and yet he is still, you know, he's. All right, he's the best for Australia, which isn't necessarily the greatest argument in favour of a great keeper. But, you know, he certainly didn't let us down last season, did he? I mean, a couple of wobbles at the beginning, but that was it.
Yeah, I think there was one big mistake he made and he got away with, which was dropping that ball in the last minute at home to Watford. But you couldn't really look at any other goals and say, oh, that was Ryan's error.
Mm. Yeah, not during the season. Izquierdo, he had one game in the opening match. Subbed and then not seen again. I mean, I think it's probably more to do with how Colombia set up. Actually, you're talking about anti-football that Colombia played. I mean, South American sides generally, they were poor during the World Cup for the most part, weren't they?
Yeah, there's a poverty to the play now. And I hark back to Brazil in a way, going back to 2002. I also watched the semi-final against Turkey they played. And the thing about Brazil, I've seen them play, I'm very lucky to have seen them play live a few times now. I'm sure Nick's probably seen loads. Mm. But I was surprised at how dirty also Brazil can be.
I've always known Brazil to be dirty.
So, you know, the South African culture, it might have to go through a bit of an evolution to catch up, because more organised teams now are more savvy. Mm. There's a bit more tactical setup to defend against that kind of flair now. So maybe that's a factor that they're resorting more to the physical side. Mm. And it's a shame because that Colombia had some really talented players, which is by going back to Esquire, they didn't play.
Well, Uruguay, I mean, they showed in flashes, you know, that they can be a fantastic attacking side. Mm. They just refused to do it quite enough, really.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you're talking about Brazil. I mean, you know, historically, let's go back to 1974. They played against the Netherlands. I mean, this was an absolutely wonderful Netherlands side who absolutely battered them off the park. And Brazil had two players sent off. And this is in the days when basically two-footed maiming might have got you a ticking off. You know, and Brazil were just hacking. And I mean, to be fair, so were the Netherlands. But and then I think even in Kevin Keegan's autobiography in 1978, where he said, you know, he played against Brazil. It was a one-all game. He scored a free kick from it. But he said his love for Brazilian football ended that night. They just kicked and hacked. Mm. And they do that age-old thing. Also, I think a lot of South America, let's stereotype here. When they try and pick you up, as they pick you up by the, you know, with the forearm, they dig the nails in. That kind of, even Gary Neville pointed out, said, the nails have
Brazil,
gone in.
Brazil remember 1966 and Pelé being kicked out of that tournament. And they, you know, they, in 70 they had a team that was so magnificent they didn't need to kick, but they do remember, you know, and when they're up against some European teams, I think they expect, well, they get their retaliation in first,
they
let's
do.
Put it that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. I mean, Brazil didn't turn up. I mean, Colombia just played this ridiculous game against England. Yeah. And you had the South Americans backing them saying, you know, this 200,000 people signing a thing saying the game should be replayed.
Oh. Just embarrassing.
You know, I mean, Harry Kane was flattened for that. And hang on, how did he foul someone who was behind him, who was trying to piggyback him, was trying to swap shorts?
Well, it makes a change, though. It's usually the other way around. It was usually us on the other end of an injustice feeling, even though it wasn't. You know,
how many penalties did we get?
6-1, isn't it, really? But,
there's proper refereeing of corners.
Yes. I mean, if
people always say, oh, well, you know, if you gave a penalty for that, you'd give six corners in a game. Well, go on then.
Go on then.
Yes.
Yeah, it did change. And VAR were the old favourites. It's a trope now, isn't it? Now,
because we're going to get to that in a sec. But yeah, I mean, Panama, admittedly, they were obviously lacking in talent, so they decided sort of like, you know,
but what was lovely when they got their goal the fans it was beautiful to watch. This is when it was a beautiful World Cup. I mean, we're talking about some of the negatives. I want to look at the positive for a minute, and I have to say I think this is my favourite World Cup, and I've only been to a few, but those ones I've seen, and I had great times culturally, but the football hasn't always been great. This time it really was great.
So you see, Colombia were a big disappointment. Why did they have such an inferiority complex against England that they felt they had to play that anti-football, when you just thought, you know, if they play the way they can, or the way they played in the last World Cup, we'd have been scared of them. But for some reason, they seem scared of us and decided to play such a negative game when they have such good players.
Mm, absolutely. So, yeah. So we had Balogun. We hadn't seen him in an Albion shirt. Played centre-back for Nigeria. I mean, again, he had a lot of work to do, didn't he?
That's an understatement. What do you think, Nick?
Okay. I mean, a lot of people, he seemed to get praised by a lot of people. A lot of commentators seemed to say, oh, you know, great work by Balogun. And you thought, well, you know, he won a header, which you'd have expected him to win. Yeah. And he played okay at right back in one of the games. I thought he did all right. I mean, he didn't make any big errors.
It's not as though the alarm bells are ringing.
He looked a lot more... I mean, you know, he looked more like an old-fashioned British centre-half to me than, you know, some sort of new... when he's spoken, you know, to Seagull's player and things, he's spoken about his, you know, German characteristics. And I think, you know, you think, well, OK, he played for Nigeria, but let's not forget the German half. And, you know, an efficient centre-half to back up Duffy and Dunk. I'm quite happy with that, but... don't think we should get carried away by anything he did in the World Cup.
I agree with that. I don't think he's a number
one. You're terrified,
aren't
you?
I'm not convinced myself, I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah, not convinced.
Okay, and Jahanbakhsh, again, not in a brilliant side.
Interesting that, because you see, when we, at the beginning of the World Cup, we were supposed to be interested in him at a price of £22 million. So I was thinking, oh, let's hope he's rubbish in the World Cup to drive his value down and we'll get him and then he'll be brilliant. But then when he was... not rubbish, but we didn't really have a chance to show much. I thought, actually, do we really want this guy?
Yeah.
But now, of course, we've got him. I'm sure he's brilliant.
The Iranian fans have since come onto social media, Brighton's social media, have all said, almost to a man, don't judge him on the World Cup. You know, he is much better than that.
Well, he didn't play every minute of every game, did he?
Well, so I think he was injured for part of it. He was injured for part of it. I know he took a free kick, I think, in his first, either the first or second game, and I think that free kick is still in orbit. It went along, and I'm thinking, welcome
ball
to
recently, Brighton. Recently collided with John Pemberton's penalty for the five penalty game.
Jason Puncheon's one, yeah.
It's somewhere over Mars.
So... probably with those four, you couldn't really necessarily tell, apart from the fact that I don't think anyone sort of was particularly let anyone down. It's not as though you think, oh my God, you know, an embarrassment for Brighton.
They were all in teams, well, apart from Escoda, who only played in a game when he was playing for a team of 10 men.
Mm.
They all played in teams that were, you know, struggling or up against superior opposition. I mean, Jahanbakhsh, you know, was in a team that was defending most of the time.
Mm.
And so, you know, you're not really going to see an attacking, you know, attacking winger at his best in a game like that.
And he's also going to be missing for a few games because of Iran's qualifications games for the next tournament. So he's going to be missing for a few for the.
Are we going to be losing Balogun
season?
As well then for this season? Do we know? Is it the Africa Cup of Nations?
Not this year. No, but
okay,
I think that it's
they move that to Summer's
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the problem we have now that we've got such great international players. They're going to be missing for international tournaments. Mm. Not been a problem for us in the past in terms of.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room. VAR.
That's very rude. I'm on a diet.
Said the popcorn in the cabinet.
And I'm sure you cycled here as well. You won't do that again, will you?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Go on.
It was supposed to be to decide in cases where there was, you know, an indecision. They're supposed to get obviously wrong decisions corrected. And then you get people looking at them for the screen for 5 minutes. Mm. It obviously wasn't that obvious.
Mm.
Like the handball in the France-Croatia game in the final. You know, if you can't tell straight away a mistake's been made, just walk away.
I think the point is about that, and I think this is totally unfair, is that when you review something in slow motion, like, for instance, that, yes, his hand went to the ball, but I think it was a natural movement of the hand. So you think, well, hang on, OK, if his hand was in a natural position, yes, the ball hits it, you can't say you can't give it, but they have this sort of kind of directive of, you know, it's got to be seen to be deliberate. I mean, it doesn't... And all these various sort of nuances... But then you've got, when you see it viewed in slow motion, it looks like a more deliberate movement. If you're going to review it, only review it in real time. Because otherwise, I think, you know, that's when you get the unfairness of what looks like, whether it was deliberate or whether it looks like it was accidental. I mean, and it's the final, that handball in the final I'm specifically talking about. So even then, there's not a correct usage of VAR, let alone how it's to use, you know, what it's there for in the first place.
Generally, but I think that's correct. It wasn't correctly used. I think the phrase they use is a clear and obvious error.
Mm.
And I think that's where it needed honing.
It's not clear, it has to be an obvious error.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the point.
When they use it in American sports like baseball, then if in doubt, the ruling on the field stands.
Yes.
So I think that should be
decision.
That should be, and there should be a time limit on, you know, you can't look at it, you can't have five replays, slow motion, oh, can we look at it a bit slower?
No,
I mean, perhaps there's got to be something like, you can have, the referee can look at it twice.
Yeah.
And if it's
and in real time,
if he can't think of, if he can't obviously see that the mistake's been made, his initial ruling stands.
Yes.
So otherwise, we'll be there all night.
I think that's where the Premier League have done well, actually. They said we'll leave it a bit and hone stuff like that. I think they're looking at how they can hone this to make it work better. And it
Premier
needs
League
to be
may
better.
Have got something right.
Yeah. I know, it's amazing.
Well, because what we never had was a game-ending VAR decision. That would have been, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, when
what
the game ends. Well, let's say, you know, a last-minute penalty, you know, in the 93rd minute, or encroachment at a penalty by the goalkeeper at a penalty shootout, at a penalty shootout. Yeah. Imagine, well, you know, some of these people encroach so much that the penalty is almost a 50-50 ball.
Mm.
And, you know, you looked at the goalkeeper, what's the linesman doing? Some of the goalkeepers were 2 yards off the line.
Mm.
You don't see...
Well, goal line technologies, yeah.
You don't see penalties retaken in shootouts, generally speaking.
Not generally, no.
But, you know, why not? some of the goalkeepers do cheat, and you know, okay, there's no encroachment because there's nobody else there on the. But
one time it has actually happened where I think it was England in the shootout. It could have been Jamie Carragher.
Jamie Carragher took it before the referee was.
Oh, was that what it was?
Had blown for the rest
of right,
but
to be fair, I think the referees were quite good actually. I think Colleen and marshalled them quite well, and a lot of the controversial decisions that were VAR related were because of VAR. But I think the referees generally were actually pretty decent.
Oh yeah, there were some very
good
referees.
Part,
yes,
yes. You know, there's no sort of real howling, screaming ones, and because red card is covered against, you know, if I mean the number of times I think that, you know, there's the times when corners were not given when, you know, it deflected off a defender.
Well, that first
I
game
don't think anyone very I don't think anyone says, oh, I wish Michael Oliver had been here.
Yeah, quite. So I mean, it's so.
Or even Jamie Oliver, that'd have been worse.
Yeah. So in going
food
into
would have been better in Russia, I have to say. That was rough. All the food.
So going into the tournament, what did you think of VAR and coming out of the tournament? Have you changed your mind?
I thought it was going to be an interesting experiment, and I think I was waiting for, as I say, one of those last gasp things, you know, an actual game to be decided in the last minute. On that didn't happen.
There was a last minute VAR penalty given, though, wasn't it? In one of the games, I'm pretty certain there was.
Can't remember.
Was
which
it
one?
South Korea? Something tells me. Anyway, it's. I think
I'm a fan if they can hone it. I think that most people would probably.
But should the World Cup have been used as such?
Well, the other thing is, I think something else someone suggested was giving the head coaches or managers a two challenges or something, or two opportunities to say, please go to VAR. That would be that would add to the gaiety of nations, I think.
yes,
controversy and give people enough.
I mean, I'm really against that idea. I mean, it should be the referees. I mean, irrespective of the fact you want to call him several kinds of, you know, challenging his parenthood, but you know,
the other interesting thing is, of course, people say, oh, well, at VAR will settle all the arguments. All they did was give the pundits even more.
That's
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And it's still going to come down to a human being decisively making a mistake.
Oh, but
or not,
because my favourite aspect of the whole VAR thing was Kalina's decision that the VAR officials back in the studio had to wear full kit. That was just
that
outstanding.
Was that was funny.
It was. I mean, it was, yes, some real FKW stuff. So, in overall, France, do you feel France were the worthy winners?
Yes. They had. If you look through, also the great French tradition of having a non-goal scoring centre forward. you know, the Stéphane Givarc in 98 for, you know, Reed, Olivier Giroud.
Yeah.
But you know, you look at the players, good players in key positions. I thought Varane was played a fantastic World Cup.
Uh-huh.
Generally speaking, you know, they scored the goal of the tournament. They had one of the outstanding players of the tournament. Well, it's a lot of the outstanding players. No, I mean, the only thing I didn't like about France was their kit. Yeah, what on earth was that navy blue and sort of grey outfit all about? I mean, I thought they were red, white and blue.
Well, maybe Phil Shelley might challenge you on that. Mark, do you think France were the worthy winners?
I was very happy to see France win it, actually, because I encountered quite a few French people out there.
No, come on. I mean, I'm only 50% British, and I can't say I was happy to...
Well,
to
happier than seeing
the best team won,
the best team won in Rome, exactly.
Would you have minded, would you have considered if Belgium had been the winners?
Well, I think they would have been a worthy team, but they weren't quite... I think Martinez... Interesting manager, but tactically it looked like he didn't quite get it right.
I was about to say, to allow to go 2-0 down to Japan.
I think there was an issue there with the way he played his team and set them up. But I like the way France approached the tournament. And they had a certain imperiousness as they got onto the tournament. They started slightly badly in classic style in the World Cup, like 82 Italy, all that.
Yeah.
And I think that what's great about subjectively for me, was out in Moscow, particularly in Russia, there were quite a few French fans unusually, and they don't always travel, but there were lots out there. And there's one particular story about this Russian who helped me out on the metro when I was still trying to decide the Cyrillic, and he said, do you want some help? Which was a common theme. And I said, you've got a French accent, and you know this place backwards. He said, I know, I've lived here for 11 years, he said. And he was a French fan, he was off to watch the game. And we had a lovely chat, and Allez les Bleus and all that, and I thought, you know, the friendliness. And I was also hark back to the time after that terrible bombing in Paris, went to the England game where we all sang La Marseillaise at Wembley, and that was an emotional, incredible moment, and I felt a bit of a soft spot for France for that reason too.
Some great anthems, weren't there? I mean, the Russian anthem is a killer.
It's amazing.
Brilliant.
And when you hear it in the stadium as well, it's incredible.
I love the fact that was sung as a pastiche in the film Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, amongst MI5 people, amongst, you know,
the office party.
That's moment. It, yeah.
No, so the fact that we're England and not Great Britain does mean that we could find a different anthem somewhere and something better than that dirge.
Yes.
Well, Billy Connolly always wanted the Archers. I'd go with that.
And with that, you have been listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. My thanks indeed to Nick Japanik and to Mark Brailsford for coming in. Tomorrow is the screening of Kaiser, the greatest footballer never to play football, at Lewis Depot, newish cinema they've got next to Lewis Station. It starts at 5:30. Tickets are still on sale. Go to the Lewis Depot website. And I'll be hosting the Q&A session with director and Albion fan Louis Miles, who came onto the show back in April after the screening. Meanwhile, there has been a re-recording of the Kaiser Chiefs' I Predict a Riot, which ties in with the film, and we're going to play out with that. The regular Albion Roar will return next week, so thanks very much indeed for listening, and we'll see you next week. Cheers for now. Bye. Também não é muito sensato.
through my